Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another Focus podcast. I am Singing Lisa, your host. So excited to be back with you. And as we mentioned on a previous episode, we are focusing on who we want to call heroes. And these people are heroes because they have survived COVID-19. So I think it's a well-deserved honor. And you are looking at another survivor of COVID-19, a hero in our eyes. And he is Dr. Robert J. Chugden. He is the chief medical officer at West Jefferson Medical Center and on the West Bank of Louisiana. And we're just excited to be able to share with him and to hear his story and his journey. So, doctor, so good to be able to speak with you. And thank you for taking some time out of your schedule. How are you today?
I am 100,000% better and feeling generally pretty good.
Yes. Well, you know, to be able to say that means you've been through some things that I know many of us don't have firsthand experience at. So please share with us, you know, where were you when, let's say, when COVID-19 started? Because you're a doctor. You're already on the front lines giving care and providing service for other people. So what was going on when you first started hearing the news of COVID-19?
Well, I think we first heard the news when everyone else did, when there was reports of a certain odd virus in China, and we hoped that it wouldn't spread here, but unfortunately it did. As soon as it did, since I'm the chief medical officer, I and the rest of the leaders in the hospital decided we had to start preparing for it. So we started preparing in efforts to get the proper amounts of protective gear and to make sure we had room and ventilators to care for the patients that might come our way. Of course, we had heard of the experiences in Seattle and then in New York, New Jersey area, since they kind of had most of these cases first. And to be honest, it was quite frightening. It sounded like a real devastating disease, and we knew that we would have to strain pretty much all of our resources to try to deal with it. But we did, and so most of our time was spent, again, trying to make sure that we had the proper protective equipment for our employees, to make sure that we had the proper rooms and areas in the hospital that we could treat these expected patients, and especially to separate them from other patients. So that's what most of the effort was around. One of the things we did very early, in fact, I believe we may have been the first in the state, was to open up a drive-through COVID testing unit in some tents outside of our emergency room doors. And that was very successful. We had big crowds from almost day one. Mm-hmm. And we proceeded like that for a while until we actually started to get overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I think we had over 130 COVID patients in the hospital, and all of our ICUs, we have three of them, were full. And we had actually opened another area that, ironically, way back during the Ebola scare, we had opened a unit to care for Ebola patients. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any Ebola patients, but we still had the unit. It was not staffed and was kind of just sitting off to the side, and we decided that we would repurpose that as a critical care area for COVID patients if we needed it. Mm-hmm. And it turned out we did. Wow. So, you know, this went on for several weeks, and part of my, when it got really bad at the hospital, where it was very stressful for our staff, they had to go in and out of cohorted units almost through an airlock type situation where it's double doors, and take off and put on protective gear from head to toe every time they left the area, and then put it back on when they went back in. So it was very stressful for the staff to have to do all this and take all these extra precautions. Of course, we followed the state issued guidelines and limited visitors, which was, again, stressful on our patients as well as our staff, because our staff doesn't like to see their patients left alone by their loved ones. And so we instituted a program fairly early on using iPads and one of the telecommunications apps so that families could kind of virtually visit their loved ones by means of an iPad video conference situation. And so we pass those out to all the units. We also use those for physicians to be able to see patients who didn't actually need the kind of hands-on touch at that moment, and that prevented the physicians from having to use the protective gear to go in and come just to see one patient and come out, because that was in fairly short supply. We never ran out. We always managed to find the supplies we needed. We did make efforts to re-sterilize or reuse a lot of the personal protective gear, particularly when we were what we call cohorting patients. In other words, we'd have an entire wing that would just be COVID-19 patients. So once you put on your gear, you didn't have to worry about infecting another patient because they were all infected anyway. Right. So you could use the gear and wear it for long periods as long as you stayed in that unit. Mm-hmm. We were doing all that, and this, again, as I said, was very stressful. So my job at the time was really focused on keeping up the morale of our nurses and doctors and therapists and what have you. And so I would go from unit to unit and try to make sure they had everything they needed. And if there were any problems, please let me know. And I could, work through the executive kind of hierarchy to get what was needed, whether it be testing or supplies or just food for a break. Yes. And again, the iPads, that was another one. My task was to go make sure everybody had adequate iPads and knew how to use them, and to use this sort of televisitation and telemedicine kind of approach. So I was doing this. We were working 7 days a week, fairly long hours. And I thought things were going pretty successfully until one day I started feeling sick. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have a cough or a fever or anything like that. I just felt a lack of energy. And I thought, oh my goodness, I wonder if I'm coming down with this COVID-19 thing. Mm-hmm. And this was in April. And I went to get myself tested. Well, at the time, we had the standard test, which many of you may recall, was taking 10 days to get results sometimes. But we had just gotten a new test in the hospital, and it promised results in a few hours. Mm-hmm. So I thought, great. So I went in to get the test, and the nurse that was running that testing site said, well, since we have this new test, we're not really sure how well it works. Just to be sure, let's do the old one, excuse me, and the new one. So I said, okay, great. And so they did the old test, which involves sticking a probe through your nose, seemingly to the back of your brain, but a very long way. And then the new test, which the probe didn't have to go so far. And so I went back to await my results. Well, a few hours later, I was called and said, the test is negative. Wow. So I thought, okay, well, I guess I just feel tired from working 7 days a week and long hours. I'll go back to work. So I went back to work and, continued what I was doing. But I just didn't feel well. I started to have these kind of earaches. But again, no fever, no cough or congestion or anything of the sort. But I didn't feel well. So I said, well, I think I'm going to go home early today. I just don't feel well. So I went home, and I was scheduled to be back the next day, which was Saturday, to work in the command center. In other words, we had two people assigned during the weekends, every weekend day, to kind of be in charge. So I was going to be one of them on that weekend, myself and one of the vice presidents. And so Saturday came, and the vice president called me while I was still at home and said, don't come in. And I said, why not? And she said, because we just got your test result back, the one that took several days.
Okay.
And it only took 3 days, fortunately. Mm-hmm. And it's positive. And I said, oh my goodness. The other one was negative. I've been here for two more days, and I was positive because they were both taken at the same time.
Yes.
So she said, yes, you know, you have, but don't come back. Whatever you do, don't come back. I said, all right, fine. So I stayed home thinking, well, I'm a healthy person. I'm not, you know, a spring chicken anymore. I'm not a young person, mm-hmm. but I'm healthy. I don't have any medical problems. I don't take any medicine. I don't have, certainly don't have breathing problems. I never smoked. Mm-hmm. This should be fine. Mm-hmm. I'll just have a flu-like syndrome. And so I stayed home. And day or two later, Sunday, I think, I started developing just tremendous joint pains, mm-hmm. just tremendous joint pains. I felt like my joints were welded solid, and I couldn't move without breaking something.
Wow.
But I still didn't have a fever until that night. Then I developed a fever, and so I just had these aches and pains and fever that seemed to go away with Tylenol up until Wednesday, and then I woke up and I couldn't breathe. I just couldn't breathe. So I called one of my doctor friends, a pulmonologist, and said, I can't breathe. What should I do?
Right.
And he said, well, that's a dumb question. If you can't breathe, you need to come into the hospital. So I came into the hospital, and my oxygen levels were very, very low. I was just as weak as could be, and my heart rate was 162.
Wow.
So I went in the emergency room. I had atrial fibrillation. My oxygen saturation was in the 70-something percent range. And so they decided that they did all the routine tests, and they decided that they would admit me to the hospital, to the coronary critical care unit. At that point, all of our critical care units were taking care of COVID patients anyway, so we didn't quite honestly distinguish between coronary critical care and regular critical care or surgical critical care. Mm-hmm. But since I had atrial fibrillation with a very fast rate, they thought the coronary unit might be better because the nurses are used to it. Mm-hmm. So I was on various medications and drips, and they put me in there, and the heart rate got better, but the breathing kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I remember thinking, well, I'm not getting worse. I'm kind of the same, until one of the doctors came in and said, you may feel the same, but we're going up on your oxygen every few hours. Wow. So I think I started out at 3 or 4 liters per minute oxygen flow, and I was now at 17. So they said, so we're going up higher and higher and higher just to keep you kind of feeling the same. And so I said, well, that's not good.
Right.
You know, that's not, surely I can't be one of these people that are going to wind up on a ventilator or dying or something like that. And so a couple of days went by, and they kept increasing the oxygen, and I really didn't get any better and was getting worse, in fact. So we had heard, this was a time when we were still hearing about how to treat COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And remdesivir had just kind of was on the scene, but it was investigational, and you had to apply to the Gilead Pharmaceuticals, I think, to be given a dose. So mm-hmm. I'll back up a second. One of the advantages I had over your average everyday patient is, since I was a physician, the physicians discussed treatment alternatives with me mm-hmm. in way more depth than they probably did the average person.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided, yeah, remdesivir might be a good idea, but we had heard of a very successful treatment of a patient at one of our local hospitals with convalescent serum. Mm-hmm. So in other words, it was a plasma transfusion, essentially, from someone who had recovered to someone who was very sick. And he had done very well. The man had done very well. Mm-hmm. So we called the local hospital and said, hey, how could we do that?
Right.
And they actually had someone there who actually was another physician who had recovered and agreed to donate his plasma.
Okay.
So he did, and I received it, and I got better fairly soon afterwards.
Okay.
For about 6 hours.
Really?
Yes. And then I started getting worse again, deteriorating. Mm-hmm. And so this went on. I was deteriorating more and more, and it was getting to the point where they were talking about maybe needing a ventilator, and we decided, no, we're going to go with this external BiPAP thing first. And so we did that, and that helped for a little while. But then again, they came in and said, you're not doing too well. And I said, what do you mean? I'm doing fine. They said, well, you're doing fine because we keep increasing the pressure and increasing the oxygen flow, and now we're at the maximum. And they said, we're going to have to put you on a ventilator. And I said, no, I don't want to be on a ventilator. Just strap that mask on as tight as you can get it and crank the pressure up as high as you can, and I'll tolerate it. Well, I didn't know what I was talking about at the time, because that it really is painful to have the mask strapped that tightly to your face.
Okay.
Because the higher the pressure of the oxygen they're delivering, the tighter the mask has to be to create a seal. So it really requires some tolerance, and it's painful across the bridge of your nose.
Wow.
But and it also requires some, you have to kind of coordinate your breathing
with it.
With it. Otherwise it blows your cheeks up like Dizzy Gillespie, for anybody who remembers Dizzy Gillespie, a trumpeter, and his cheeks would get huge when he'd blow a trumpet. Anyway, so we did that. And one of my doctors arranged for another plasma transfusion under a program that the Mayo Clinic was running in Rochester, Minnesota. And so we got another dose of plasma, another unit of plasma. And I received that. And again, I got better. But this time I continued to get better. So I don't know if that was second time's a charm, or if it was plasma that had more antibodies. I don't know. Or sometimes it just takes two or three, I'm told. But anyway, I managed to improve and continue to improve, and my oxygen needs decreased. I was still COVID positive, though. They had run a test after I had recovered pretty significantly. I was still on oxygen, but and it was still positive.
Now, at this point, were you still in the hospital?
I was still in the hospital. Yeah, I was still in the critical care unit.
Okay.
And so the decision, well, at this point, I probably didn't need critical care anymore, and they were going to send me to a room, a floor. And I basically said, look, my wife's a nurse. I can take care of myself at home. If I don't need critical care, couldn't I just go home? And so we had to kind of see, they had to kind of walk me around the lobby, well, not the lobby, but the nurse's area in critical care, wheeling my oxygen tank and checking my oxygen saturation to see if it was adequate enough to go home. And they determined that it was. And so after about 2 weeks, I was discharged home with home oxygen. And so I've been there, well, I was home pretty much the entire month of May, June, up until just now at the beginning of July. The funny thing to me is that I experienced almost no improvement in my breathing or my ability to do any activity for almost the whole 2 months, probably about six and a half weeks.
So your energy was just depleted.
It was totally depleted. Wow. And if you were to ask me on June 10th, if I felt better than I did when I was discharged from the hospital, I would have told you, no, I feel exactly the same. And I was concerned. I was afraid that I wasn't going to get any better, that there was permanent damage to my lungs and that this was it. And I'd forever be bound to an oxygen tank. And not be able to do any physical activity. I mean, taking a shower was just exhausting, and I'd get short of breath and such, much less walking anywhere. I once tried to walk to the mailbox to get the mail and came back and I almost blacked out before I got to my door.
Wow.
And that actually triggered another episode of atrial fibrillation, which I had to get converted again. And so I didn't really feel like there was any progress made at all until really about a week and a half to maybe 2 weeks ago. And then I started getting better noticeably day by day by day. In fact, one time in the middle of this, I went back to the hospital for a visit to my pulmonologist who had treated me in the hospital, and he got another chest x-ray and a CAT scan of my chest because it looked horrendous. I mean, I look at x-rays, so it's hard to explain to someone who doesn't, but there's an appearance that certain x-rays have that you see with chronic scarring, like people who have had terrible cancers or tuberculosis or
who are smoking
forever, you know, just heavy smoker. But they develop this pattern in their lungs that looks like a lot of scar tissue, and it never gets better. It just is what it is. And that's what it looked like. And so we did a CAT scan, which showed, it's probably not scar tissue. It's probably just this swelling, and maybe that'll go away. And so fortunately it did.
Yes.
And so I was very grateful for that. But for the longest time, I thought, oh my God, this is it. I'm going to be a pulmonary cripple for the rest of my life. And, you know, there's nothing else I could do about it. I looked at it, the whole experience I looked at, both at, from the viewpoint of a patient and a physician.
Yes.
So on the one hand, I was a patient and I was afraid like anyone else would be. I mean, when they said they wanted to put me on a ventilator, I knew that at that time, up to 65% of people who get put on a ventilator were going to die.
Yes.
And I knew that when they put me on a ventilator, they would essentially anesthetize me. They'd put you on this drip where you're totally unconscious. And so I knew that that moment, that might be my last moment on earth. Just the moment where I made that decision, I'll go on a ventilator, I may never wake up and I wouldn't even know it.
Yes.
So I didn't want to do that. I was afraid of that. For some reason, I was more afraid of going to sleep and not knowing what was going to happen than I would have been if they just said, okay, you're going to die tomorrow or something. It was that not knowing that it was very scary to me. And, you know, I'm sure to anyone who's been in that position, but, you know, I had the disadvantage of knowing what the mortality rate was. So that was bad. And really throughout the whole recovery period, you know, you try to be hopeful, but when things don't seem to be improving, you get down, you know, you get a little depressed and such. I don't think I ever lost faith entirely, but I felt bad. I mean, I was disappointed more than once throughout this ordeal.
Yes.
But I fortunately had a lot of friends and family who were concerned and who sent me wishes and prayers and little gifts and what have you throughout the whole thing.
Yes.
I even had people texting me every day while I was in the CCU, and I almost felt like first of all, I didn't have any energy to text back, but I almost felt like saying, would you quit texting me every day? I'm in the freaking critical care unit. Give me a break here. But you know, they meant well, and I appreciate their concern and their thinking of me.
And that was their only way of connecting with you.
And I really appreciate that they thought of me in several cases every day.
Yes.
Because they would text me every day, how are you doing, you know?
Yes.
Any improvement?
Well,
you
said something that really has been a very, very heavy conversation, not only as of late, but the mental aspect of this entire process has just been probably harder on people who cannot see their family, as well as the recovery aspect. And so you have firsthand experience being there, not being able to reach out to people who love you. And so what an advantage to at least even have the texting, even though it was annoying at times.
It is. And I should have said something about that, because the other thing is being alone in the room without the people you love that you normally see and depend on. Is terrible. And I will say that the nursing staff was wonderful. They did everything they could to make me feel better or to, you know, lift my spirits or whatever.
Yes.
But there's no substitute for your family.
That's all right.
And although I FaceTimed my wife pretty well every day at least when I could. Mm-hmm. There's no substitute for being there. And again, I have to speak. I speak very highly of the nursing staff. They were. I had a problem with my nutrition because, as you probably heard, you lose your taste, and so you actually and you don't have the energy to eat. And when you try to eat, it feels like you're eating cardboard, and so you don't eat, right. And so you start losing weight, and that makes you actually weaker.
Yes. Your,
what we call protein metabolism starts to fall off, mm-hmm. and so. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. But your protein metabolism starts to fall off, and you need that to help recover. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. the nurses were wonderful. I mean, the community was wonderful in that they donated food for the nursing staff,
yes.
and the nursing staff shared it with me. So yes. I got food from some of the best restaurants around,
yeah.
which helped a great deal.
I'm sure.
It made you want to eat and,
yes.
and kind of be able to eat. So that was... Mm-hmm. That was a bright spot there, I
yes.
think.
Well, I have to say, you know, I love your experience just because you have two sides to mm-hmm. it as a patient, but also a doctor. And I know that you probably can debunk some myths that nurses are really at the top of the list when it comes to being important in a hospital, because many people depend on a doctor, but could you really mm-hmm. be the best you are without a nurse?
No, I tell you, I tell them all the time, you guys, the nurses, you're my eyes and ears. I depend
yes.
on you because I can't be everywhere at once. I can be taking care of one patient, but I have 20 patients or 30 or 100 or whatever it is.
Yes.
And I depend on all of you to make sure everything's going well and tell me what I need to know and direct me where I need to go. So as a physician, they do that.
So
as a from a physician side, we absolutely need them, and they do a huge amount of work keeping us on track
yes.
as physicians.
Mm-hmm.
As a patient, in all honesty, they're the ones who care for you. And I say care meaning care.
Hands-on.
Hands-on. They care. Well, they care about you. They make you feel like somebody cares about
yes.
you. The doctors are great for, you know, they know what medicine to give you or mm-hmm. what surgery to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the nurses who really provide that feeling of care for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very important to me as a patient. And
yeah.
look, I haven't been a patient since, you know, forever, since I was like 5 years old. So
right.
I don't have any experience,
yes.
particularly as a patient
yes.
up to now.
Right.
But
my
I
goodness.
Can see that's incredibly important. It can make or break your hospital stay, believe
yes.
me.
Oh, my goodness. Well, the stories are endless
yes,
that we've
they
heard
are.
Across the country, in New Orleans, in Louisiana, around the world, of just the difference that nurses have made. The people
oh
on the
gosh,
front
yes.
line, they have gotten all the attention and deserve so much more because of the effort that no one knows on the outside
mm-hmm.
about what it's like. I mean, literally, it's been compared to being in a MASH unit because it was so intense in the beginning. And so thankfully, things have come to some maybe leveling off. Well, maybe because we have this uptick
yeah.
going on now.
Well, I know.
What's your thought about that? Because
well,
you've been, you know, on the other side.
Interestingly, mm-hmm. I was just communicating with our state health officer today
mm-hmm.
About this. And one of the things that's confusing is when you watch television or listen to the news, you hear about, oh, the new cases. To be honest, that's a totally meaningless thing.
Okay.
What you want to look at is hospitalizations and ICU use. And you could look at deaths too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and what you see is that hospitalizations were very, very high back in, they peaked around
late April. Mm-hmm.
And now it's way, 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 way lower, but it's starting to trend up again. So
mm-hmm.
the last week or so in Louisiana, I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
The hospitalization rate is going up, but the ICU rate is not going up and
mm-hmm.
the death rate's not going up. So what we're seeing is we're seeing younger people who have it, but
mm-hmm.
not quite as bad,
mm-hmm.
you know, bad enough to be in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
but not to where, oh my gosh, they're going to need a ventilator, right, or they're going to die or something.
And so these people would be considered like the carriers, or they were
correct.
They were at home and just weren't around anyone, and all of a sudden with the release
correct
of everything.
Exactly. And so there are people who have apparently no symptoms at all, and yet they can still be somewhat contagious. We're not really sure.
Yeah.
As the initial thought was, well, to be contagious, you have to, you know, cough or breathe out germs. So if you're not coughing, you're not going to shoot out a bunch of germs. You might do a little when you're breathing, but if you don't have a cough or sneezing, you probably don't have enough virus to cause those symptoms, so you probably don't have enough to breathe out much anyway. So that's the thought, but we don't know. But the other issue that we have with numbers is that most of the statistics that are gathered in Louisiana and in other states are positive tests. Okay, I can tell you in my ordeal, I had 7 tests.
Really?
Right. 3 were negative, 4 were positive. So technically, I was counted 4 times.
Wow.
Now, in Louisiana at least, and I can't speak for other states, there are state epidemiologists who try to go through all those tests and match up names or, you know, some identifier so they're not double or triple or quadruple counting people. But even they admit, we can't. That's a manual process, and so we can't be sure, you know, if we're doing that. And in fact, the state health officer just told me there were over 380,000 tests done in June alone in Louisiana. And so you can imagine what a huge job that would be to try to match up everyone. So when you hear a news report that says, oh, there's X number of new cases, really, you don't know, are those cases of people who have minimal to no symptoms, or are they cases that, like me, might have been counted 4 times, and it's really, you know, 1 case, not 4 cases.
Really good point.
And the average person who is positive typically has more than 1 test, sometimes 2, but often we're finding people with 4 seems to be a good number. And it really, because if you're positive, usually they want to do a confirmatory test. Okay, you're positive. Then you're going to get a test to see if when you're negative, and if you happen to be not negative yet, that's
another
positive.
Another test. That is
a
great point.
You know,
and do you have to be tested negative twice to be released or what?
Well, you do. A lot of policies for employment and mostly for employment because school's out, require you to have 2 consecutive negative tests before you can be considered negative. Like, for instance, when I got home, I was still positive. The test I had on my day of discharge was still positive. So I had to come back. I came back in a week or so, and I had a negative test. I went, okay, great. And I thought, and everyone thought, oh, he's going to recover quickly. He'll be back at work in no time. So they said, okay, you got to quick get another negative test. You got to get it. And so, you know, I waited, and I got another test, and it was positive.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no. So, you know, I had to get 2 more negative tests. So,
in what span of time?
Well,
consecutive.
Well, interesting. It doesn't matter. If you have 2 consecutive tests, like if you have 1 test, it's negative, and you have another test 3 weeks later, it's negative, then you're considered negative. If you have 1 test, when I first got discharged, our idea was we'll have a test on 2 days, one after the other. Well, the first one was negative, the second one was positive, so that's no good. So, okay, we'll wait a week.
Right.
So we wait a week, and that was positive again.
Oh, my
goodness. Well, we'll wait another week. So another week, okay, it's negative. And then another week is positive, although I think I waited about 10 days because I was still getting
better.
You know, well, at that time I wasn't. You know, in that early period, the first 6 weeks or so when I got out of the hospital, I really wasn't getting better.
Okay.
I mean, but so, you know, I didn't really feel like coming back in for another test.
Yeah.
So I kind of fudged and delayed it about 10 days, but then it was negative. So I was no longer contagious or infected, but I still had the lung issues where I couldn't breathe very well.
Right. Well, I've seen so many different people with different, you know, outcomes, not including death, but those that have just become so weakened that they've needed therapy. I've seen people
right.
whose limbs just looked lifeless and they were still released,
right.
Obviously because probably the bed was needed. But,
right.
you know, what does that mean when someone is in need of the physical therapy afterwards? I mean, it just seems like such an aggressive attack on
it
the
is.
Body.
It is. Well, first of all, just being in the hospital for 10 days, 2 weeks, is going to make your muscles weaken and get kind of what we call atrophied.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not uncommon, even before the COVID thing, that people who are in the hospital for that period of time, you would have to send them to either, if they were not too bad, you can send them home with physical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
People would come to the house and exercise them, you know, once or twice a day. Or you'd send them to a skilled nursing facility
mm-hmm.
where the physical therapist would work on them. If they were really, really debilitated, you'd send them to the rehab, a rehab unit or a rehab hospital where essentially it's a hospital setting,
mm-hmm.
but they do
Focus
a lot of
that.
Rehab. Yeah, they do
mm-hmm.
a lot of physical rehab. In my case, I did experience that, but I went home and I had some dumbbells and barbells and I thought, well, I can manage this on my own. I don't need a physical therapist. So, but yeah, you have to do that because you're very, very weak. Everything is like an effort to do. I mean, I'm still not 100%. I have a little bag I carry.
Yeah, we'll show
stuff.
Everybody.
And I have this little bag, and I can't do that. My arm
okay.
is not strong enough to hold the bag.
Wow.
And so I have to kind of do it a little bit
Gently.
And get in and
yeah.
a little more.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm still not 100%, but... You know, it's
better
obviously
than
much,
you were.
Much, oh, yeah, much,
My
much
goodness.
Better. And it, you know, and I'm 2 months out, so
wow.
it obviously is a long-term thing. It takes a while to
yes.
get better. And it really, you know, depends on what kind of shape you're in before
yes.
you went in. Now, I wasn't an athlete or anything, but
yes.
I was reasonably functional.
Mm-hmm.
But people who get
have
it,
the underlying
who
issues.
Have underlying issues, who
mm-hmm.
maybe have, are, you know, debilitated for other reasons.
Yes.
They're going to have a very,
yes.
very long recovery, I would suspect.
Yes.
And that's what we're seeing.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a lot of that. The muscles are just, in fact, I held up my arm and kind of and looked and said, oh, my God, I have like old, you know, no offense to any grandmas, but old grandma arms, you know, that kind of shake.
Women can relate to that.
Oh, my goodness. But, you know, I thought, oh, gosh, where did that come from?
Yeah. Well, so. I tell you, Dr. Chugden, you have really informed me and all of our listeners and those watching with so much valuable information. But let me ask you a question that only you can answer.
Okay.
How have you changed from the doctor you were before COVID-19 to today?
I'll be honest with you. I appreciate nurses more. And if you'd asked me before, I would have said I was one of the doctors who actually thought more highly of nurses than average doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true, but now even more so. So there's that. I think that I still haven't really processed this part. And I'll just say, you know, there are people who talk about, oh, you know, these COVID survivors are all subject to PTSD and such like that.
Mm-hmm.
I really haven't felt any signs or symptoms of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that it makes you look at your life and your surroundings differently just when you realistically confront the possibility that, you know, you're not going to be here tomorrow, or you're not going to, you know, you're not going to ever wake up or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say, oh, you know, I've thought about that, but you realistically face it. And, you know, it happens in a lot of situations. It happens in lots of illnesses. It happens
mm-hmm.
in, you know, violence situations,
sure.
whether it be war or a crime where you're faced with, oh, my God, I might be killed.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes you reevaluate, I guess, the value of what you're doing with your life.
Yes.
And so I definitely feel that,
mm-hmm.
you know, definitely. So I hope it makes me a better person. I really do. I think so far it has. It's made me a more grateful person. Although, truth be told, very few people have experienced it so far because I've been home with pretty much no visitors or anything for the longest time.
I was going to ask that. So well, when you went home, were there other family members?
Right now all my kids are grown up mm-hmm. and gone, so it's just my wife and I. Mm-hmm. And she's been wonderful. She's taken care of me like a champ the whole time.
And you said she's a nurse.
She's a nurse. Strangely, she has not ever gotten, she's not been COVID positive and even had the antibody test, which they read as saying, oh, you haven't even been exposed to it. And she said, are you crazy? She was with me for a week before I went in the hospital, right. And then I came home positive. Now, we tried to keep socially distanced, sure. and slept in separate rooms and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But still, we're in the same household. Mm-hmm. My kids, you know, we had most of the neighbors, friends, and kids have kind of kept distant just because of the whole kind of social distancing, because they don't know absolutely. If they're sick. Not that they want to get it from me, but to be honest, we're not even sure if you can catch it again. If you can, I had such a tough time the first time, they don't want it to be worse the second time.
So, and is that where the antibody tests come in?
It does, but, you know, the question with the antibodies apparently seem to work, because I got plasma transfusions mm-hmm. with asthma antibodies and they work. Mm-hmm. The question is, how long do they last? So, you know, I'll get antibody tests for months to come and see. And it may be that I have antibodies for the first few months and then, you know, next month I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Supposedly there are cases of people who have gotten it twice. So the fear is that, well, maybe your antibodies go away after a while. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not a scientist, but there's a concept in immunology called an amnestic response, which means if you get something once, your body produces antibodies, and then the antibodies may fade away. But if you get it again, your body knows how to make them, so it makes them real quickly and in big numbers. That's in fact how people get anaphylaxis, like a bee sting. Mm-hmm. Your first bee sting, you react to it. It's the second one that kills you, where you get this overwhelming response. So there may be an amnestic response to this, not, you know, that would be dangerous, probably be good, mm-hmm. that maybe the antibodies do go away, but if you get it again, your body will produce, you know, a gazillion antibodies and you'll just have a mild case instead mm-hmm. of a bad case. The best situation would be if it's like some other viral diseases like smallpox, mm-hmm. Polio, where you get antibodies and they just kind of stay with you forever and you mm-hmm. never get it again.
They're just mumps ready and waiting.
Yeah, they're just ready and waiting.
And that's the idea behind the flu discussion.
Right, right.
That was so much of the talk in the beginning, that this was similar to flu.
Right.
Because, and I think the thought now is hopefully in the coming months or the coming year or the season, that this would be similar to the flu, that if it did come back, hopefully it wouldn't be something that couldn't be controlled.
Yeah, that's true. Although the problem with the flu is there's different mutations of the flu, and that's why there's a flu shot every year.
Yeah.
And the problem with the flu shot every year is they base the flu shot on stuff that they see in the Far East, China and mm-hmm. Thailand and all this. Mm-hmm. And they think, okay, well, that's going to migrate toward the Europe and the United States. So mm-hmm. they make a flu vaccine based on that. Sometimes they're wrong. And that's when you hear these things, oh, the flu shot didn't work that year, you know. And sometimes they're right, and then it works pretty well, and mm-hmm. you know. But that's why they have to make a new one every year. So if this coronaviruses apparently don't mutate as much as influenza viruses. So the hope is if they make a vaccine for this, it'll stay good for a while, or if it does mutate, it'll be just a little one and it'll still work. So,
well, that would be great.
It would be
great. I have to say thank you again, because you have given us your time and you've shared so much personal insight on this experience. And so what is your optimistic look for the city, for people? Should we continue wearing masks? I mean, I know that everybody still doesn't have all of the answers, but are we headed in the right direction with the distancing? And
I think so. I mean, I think as long as we have evidence that it's prevalent in the area, which we do, because we have tests that show it, and we have hospitalizations that show it. As long as we have that, I think mask wearing is a good idea. And what people have to remember is that you wear a mask not for you. It doesn't protect you. It protects everyone else. And for people who say, oh, a mask doesn't do any good, I read some study or whatever, almost always they read a study that says a mask won't protect you from breathing in something. That's true. It won't, unless it's an N95 mask, which filters, you know, most stuff. The high filtration masks do protect you, no question. These kind of masks, like we have now, no, these don't protect you. They protect other people from you. And if you don't believe that, think about why about 100 years ago did people in surgery start wearing these. It's so they didn't breathe germs into people's bodies while they were cutting on them. So they work. They actually work. And so they do prevent you from spreading germs. Do they prevent 100%? No, but they prevent you from spreading germs. If I put this on and I cough, some air is going to escape out here and out the sides, but the bulk of it is going to go straight in here, and it's going to filter out any little particles of saliva or whatever, and it won't make, it won't make it 6 feet. And so it does help. There have been, you know, oddly, years ago, probably 20 years, my 34-year-old son, when he was in junior high, that's how long ago it is, did a science project where they got kids, during flu season, where they got kids to wear masks. They asked kids to wear masks to school for, I think it was a month or 6 weeks. And they said, okay, we want you to wear masks to school. And then they took one group of the kids and they said, we're going to incentivize you by making masks with colorful logos and designs on them that were popular at the time, like, you know, Pokemons or whatever they were. But at any rate, things that were appealing to the kids. So they found out two things. One, the masks that were appealing to the kids were more popular and were worn more. The masks that weren't were not. But then when they looked at the absenteeism over the next month or so of the kids due to illness, which was the flu, it was way, way lower in the group that wore masks. So evidence. You know, that gives you some evidence that it probably helps. The Japanese have been doing it for a long time in crowded areas, and they really haven't seen the spread of diseases like coronavirus, for that matter, the pandemic-type spread within their country and their cities that we see in other areas. And it, one of the reasons, I believe, is because they have a culture that believes in protecting others, that they have a duty to their community. And so I would say wear a mask. You protect other people by wearing a mask, not yourself. You know,
definitely wash your hands.
And wash your hands, of course. Absolutely. You wash your hands, wear a mask, keep 6 feet away from people so that you're not breathing down their neck, and you will minimize the spread of the disease. Will you stop it? No. But you will minimize the spread of the disease. I think we're going to get through this. Unfortunately, I think it's going to take a while because it's really going to take it. That sounds stupid, but you really kind of want it to spread more because once you can get...
Is that the herd immunity?
It is. It's a herd immunity concept that if you have 100 people and 90 of them already have the disease, then the disease can't jump anymore. It's got, you know, it's got to jump 25 capacity. Times to find those 10 that haven't had the disease. And if you have immunity for a significant period afterwards, it doesn't have to be for life, but even if it's, you know, a few months, that might be enough to stop the spread, because if it's, you get enough people who have it in that few months and then they're all over it and they're all immune, it's going to have nowhere to go. And so it's a difficult situation, and I'm, you know, I might have been inclined before I got sick to say, oh, just let everybody get it, and you know, the 1% that are going to die, they probably would have died anyway. But now that I've had it, I realize, wait a minute, I don't want to be one of those guys. You realize, geez, this is really a bad illness, and I don't want to get it. I don't want anybody else to get it.
Right. Every life matters.
And so every life matters, right. I don't want this to spread through my community or any community, because there's going to be a lot of people who are going to die from it if it's becomes really widespread.
Yes.
That said, though, sometimes if you could somehow let it spread through the healthy young population that were very unlikely to get sick, that would be an advantage. That would help. But how do you do that without spreading it to mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, or, you know, or somebody who maybe not old but has
everybody's moving.
Other debilitating condition?
Sure. Well, this has been one,
it's a tough one.
History lesson for us all. My goodness. Thankfully, it was 100 years before it happened again.
I hope it's another 100 or 200.
Yes.
Trying to think of my grandchildren.
Well, you're a part of the reason why we will do better, because the medical community, scientists in particular, working very hard to come up with
that
vaccine that will answer a lot of all of that is confusing everybody. So I hope that, you know, your life continues to flourish and that you have many, many healthy days. And have you instituted other practices that you're going to continue since all of this?
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, to be honest, I haven't done much because I'm still sort of recovering. I'm just getting my, I tell people, I'm just kind of getting my feet on the ground.
Yeah.
I'm going to be much more focused on preventing infection spread in my life and in this hospital than I was before. Now, I was before, but it's even more, it's like personal
laser
now.
Laser focus now.
It's personal now.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
And, you know, just before this, I was at meetings basically discussing some infections that we had and how we can prevent them from ever happening again. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do to make sure everybody's doing it so that we don't have these things. So, you know, there's certainly stuff we can prevent, and we need to prevent it. And like I said, I'm personally focused on it now. Nothing makes a believer out of you like
experience.
Surviving some experience like that. Yes. Yes.
Well, we are absolutely thankful that you've survived, and we definitely are proud to call you one of the heroes, because you are here to tell the story. We know that there are many, many heroes who go unnoticed and unrecognized, which
there
is why we are really thankful that many frontline recognition is happening throughout the hospitals, throughout all of the communities, and it's just necessary. And I think it really teaches a valuable lesson that everybody's important and everybody serves a purpose and a role, especially people at the store when you kind of didn't think they were, you know, they were replaceable, but suddenly
you really find out when suddenly something's not there anymore.
Yes,
and
that
you
people
go, oh,
are
my
important.
Goodness.
Yeah, everyone, we have been given great information and spent some great time with Dr. Chugden, and we're so glad that he still remains the chief medical officer at West Jefferson Medical Hospital, and I know that everyone is thrilled to have you back, and we're just happy to be a part of that welcome back process, and we just know that better days are coming, especially with everybody being reinvigorated and about making everybody healthier and better. So once again, thank you for stopping by the Focus Podcast, and we have spotlighted a great doctor. And until next time, stay focused.
Thank you.